both analyst and patient will have to share a bitter taste of abandonment, of boredom, of emptiness, and they'll have to remain together. Because together they'll be able to construct something to get out of it.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and Off the Couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz. I'm an analyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Association of New York and the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia. My guest today is Dr. Jose Zussman, who is a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst in Rio de Janeiro. He is a training analyst and a professor at the Psychoanalytic Society of Rio de Janeiro, and he's a professor and supervisor of psychoanalytically oriented psychotherapy for the psychiatry residents at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro, where he holds a master's in psychiatry and also a PhD in psychoanalysis. As you will hear in today's interview, Dr. Zussman discusses with us an exquisitely sensitive understanding of the early trauma and lack of resonances that one can find in the lives, the early lives, of patients who later become addicted. And he also describes, again, very sensitively, how one, as a depth psychotherapist and an analyst, can listen and ameliorate some of the pain in the patient's inner lives that lead them to turn to addictive substances. With great pleasure, here is my interview with Dr. Zussman. Dr. Zussman, welcome to our podcast. It's a pleasure to have you with us. As you know, one of the challenges that we all face when we meet an addictive patient is that we know that there are thoughtful clinicians who recommend that a psychoanalytic approach not be included in our evaluation and treatment of these patients. We also know that there are thoughtful clinicians who feel that a psychoanalytic approach is vital to our understanding and treating addictive patients. Let's begin, if you would share with us your understanding and how you came to have your understanding about what is vital about a psychoanalytic approach and what exactly you mean when you say you recommend a psychoanalytic approach in working with addictive patients.
First of all, thank you for the invitation, Harvey. It's a pleasure to be here. And my story about beginning treating addict patients began in an unexpected way. Before I was a psychoanalyst, I was a psychiatrist. I came from medicine, and I do have a lot of friends who are psychiatrists. And I began to receive patients from these psychiatrist colleagues who would call me and say, listen, I've done everything I could. I need some extra help. I don't know what to do anymore. Could you see this patient with me? And that's how I started seeing patients, addicted patients that were very difficult patients and who didn't respond well to the psychiatric formal treatment. So in the beginning, I do have to say, I always started working together with the psychiatrists because they call me to work with them. From then on, I took this work to university where I called several friends to study the subject with me and help patients over there too. So I have my private practice and I have my practice at university, which is public. What I have to say now is that there is a difference that has to be very clear if you want to work together with other colleagues from the health field. Addiction is a symptom. but it doesn't begin with a symptom. Rarely a disease begins with a symptom, but the symptom is a sign that there is something wrong going on. So we do need something to smooth down the symptom, and the medicine is good for that. But we need something else. We need to go to the very beginning of life. We have to go to the first relationships that this patient had with the environment and the people, his caretakers, from the beginning. There's something else that's very important. We as species, we are born with our nervous system very incomplete. So when we are born, we are still producing as many neurons and neuron connections that we do when we are inside the womb. So the environment becomes fundamental because we carry on developing something that's not ready yet. And I think that with the help of those colleagues from the health field who can smooth the symptom and help the person not to suffer, we can go deep. We can go and understand the beginning of the relationships and the connections the person establishes with the world, because there is where the addiction begins.
You mean that we are early on essentially object seeking, and that in your experience with addictive patients, something went awry in their early object seeking in terms of the responsiveness of the environment?
That's it. Exactly what I'm saying.
How does one address that in treatment? That's a profound observation about the mental life of a particular patient. It's a tall order, obviously, to get involved in early, and you're describing primitive misconnections between objects. What's the path in treatment?
One thing that calls my attention is the degree of the distortion those people have of the reality. They see the same thing you do, but they connect those things in a different way. As I'll show an example that I have here with me, I'll show it later. It's something that sometimes gets you astonished because it's completely different from what you lived with the patient, because it distorted everything. And this distortion has a purpose because it repeats the early scenes the person lived when he or she first came into the world.
Now, let me ask you, just to clarify the particulars of working with addictive patients, what you just described, that is, that somebody is repeating early distorted patterns from childhood, is ubiquitous in our species and takes place on primitive levels and neurotic levels as well. What's different for the addictive patient?
The route, the path they take, because they can't find what they need, so they have to find what they can. More or less, like the concept of Winnicott of true and false self.
Could you explain how that applies and what makes the addictive patient unique and the treatment unique?
Once we're born, we have to survive. The first movement we make for this survival is to connect to other human beings. Mm-hmm. As a human being, and we are a very dependent species, and as I said before, our nervous system is very slow in its development. We'll need a lot of support to improve itself, go ahead, and find a way of becoming human. There's a difference between hominization and humanization. We are born humans, but we need to relate to humans to become humans. So if we don't interact, if there is no a proper attunement between our needs and the ones that are perceived by our caretakers, that's our very first trauma, that we don't get what we need. So we'll have to go searching for other elements to carry on a life.
And you're saying that these patients turn to addictive sensations and substances to compensate for the lack of resonance?
Sure. The ones who can, because if you remember, there's a colleague of us, Spitz, who defined a kind of depression, an eclectic depression, of babies that were left by the mummies very early, a few months after they're born, and they enter a kind of protesting mode and cry a lot, and then they give up. Some of them end up dying. But the ones who don't die, they don't die because they find another way to connect their affection and remain alive.
Am I understanding you correctly that what, to answer the question, the beginning, which is what it is you feel that is vital for the psychoanalyst to bring to the treatment of addictive patients, is an awareness of a sensitivity to this need to be recognized, this need to be known.
That's fundamental.
You know what's so fascinating? And in talking with other colleagues on these podcasts, analysts who, like yourself, work off the couch, that is that they bring an analytic perspective to venues that are, let's say, untraditional, that they are all, everybody is saying in their own language the same thing. That I spoke to Merope Michelelli, who works in Athens with perinatal mothers, Gavriel Hertz, who's from Toronto, who works with dialysis patients, Jorge Olnick, who works with dermatology patients, that there is some early flaw in development that the analyst uniquely appreciates. And it's to be known and it's to be recognized. The question it brings to me is how one goes about treating that. Even if we accept that that is in fact the case, that that's a major contributory to all these fundamental somatic conditions, how do we address it in our work?
It's a very good question. I try to have a good answer for that. Usually a good question hasn't got a good answer, but I'll try to do my best. We do have the impression that we seek happiness. We want to feel happy. We want to feel good. And usually this is the way. A baby is born, it's not feeling comfortable, it meets the care and the love of his caretakers, he feels better, and he is beginning to construct his life. But with an addict, I think the path is a bit different. An addict does not seek happiness. They cling to any kind of connective element that makes them feel alive. I mean that, and to feel alive, the fundamental, the first part of feeling alive is to be seen. They have to get this impression that they're being seen, that somehow what they need is being offered to them. Although with the addict patients, it's usually false.
Is it a fair characterization that absent access to their inner affects, such patients instead turn to sensations, which aren't gratifying for more than a moment, but do sort of act as facsimiles for feelings. They're hyper gestures, they're hyper sensations. And our task is to help them recognize that aside from these at times dramatic and self-destructive sensations, there is a quality of affective, object-related attachments, desires, frustrations, excitements, etc., that we can introduce them to ideally in the relationship, in the transference.
Sure. I think that in the beginning, one of the most important thing is to know that both analyst and patient will have to share a bitter taste of abandonment, of boredom, of emptiness, and they'll have to remain together, because together they'll be able to construct something to get out of it.
That's beautifully put, and not easy.
Not easy. Never said it was easy.
No, I hear you. I hear you. It is possible. Let that segue into the case you can share with us.
Some years ago, I was looked for a patient, and this is not the proper name. It's a false name. And her name was, I'm going to call her Sally. And Sally was the youngest of four sisters. And she came for treatment about 8 years ago. And she had about 40 years of age. And she came because of her feelings of depression that were intensified by the recent death of her father. She had a very contentious marriage and although having tried very hard, they were unable to have children. Now, that's the point. Her own mother had not wanted her and told her explicitly all the time. She didn't want to have Sally when she became pregnant. She attempted to secure an abortion on many occasions. However, she was finally forced by the doctor to stop searching because her pregnancy had advanced too far. As soon as she was born, her mother became severely depressed, and Sally has to be sent to her grandmother's house for about 3 months. She was not breastfed. Her mother, due to her fragility, dedicated herself only to her own needs and cared little about the rest of the family. And her father, who was defined by her as a good man, worked too much. When he got home, he had to take care of her mother, who was always depressed and in need of a great deal of attention. And I'll just describe the beginning for it not to get too long. In our first session, Sally hardly spoke. I'm used to that. Nothing to amaze me. Because for this kind of patients, to speak is very difficult because they live in a concrete atmosphere where words are not very necessary. But on the second time she arrived, she came in a furious state, saying that I had been very aggressive to her. I had said nothing on our first encounter. Very aggressive to her. And that she realized that I had almost physically assaulted her, and she had felt very scared of me. Well, I considered myself a very kind person, so that was not me. Anyway, she continued saying that she didn't know why I had disliked her so much, and that she would only continue her treatment with me because she had no other option. She had tried many other colleagues and with bad result. And my feeling was one of perplexity. I was astonished. I had not felt the way she described, but quite the opposite. I felt sorry for her and for her pain. On the other hand, at that point, her distorted perception by her transference was so powerful, I felt like she wasn't seeing me at all, and there was nothing to do to convince her that she was welcome in our sessions. And she continued. Later, as she began to tell me her story a long time after that, I had the impression that our initial sessions, she was enacting the beginning of her own life when she had been so rejected by her mother. In my mind, I had the picture of a baby that after waiting far too long for food and affective shelter, she entered in a kind of a protesting mode, in which she could no longer accept what she so desperately needed because she had to complain so fiercely for being left alone. It took a long time until she stopped being so aggressive and could listen to me. Once she came and said, I don't expect anything from anyone because I always get disappointed at the end. I learned that my fate was to be lonely from the beginning to the end of my life. I don't have and never had a proper family. We are a bunch of people put together with no definite purpose, and each one had to fight for his own life. No one ever talked to anyone in my family. My father was weak, but at least he was kind, a good man. Now he died and I have nothing. I have a husband, but the scene is the same. I don't love him. He doesn't love me. She told me she spent her entire day in her room because the world was so awful, and at least in there she felt safe. She didn't go out much because if she confirmed how bad the world really was, she would not be able to stand it. She could even think about killing herself. In her room, she would stay all day long, alternating between taking sleeping pills and stimulants. She was able to buy from nearby pharmacy without a medical prescription. And she would also watch soap operas, all the soap operas she could, probably, I think, trying to see a type of life she could never find for herself. And then I tried to say something. I said, but now we are here and we are relating to each other and I'm seeing you and you're seeing me in real life without acting, not through a screen, but for real, she didn't answer, said nothing.
It's probably the first person in her life to not only say such a thing, but actually engage with her on that level.
Yeah. For almost 2 years, I mostly listened to her since she left me no room to talk. Although we agreed to have 5 sessions a week, she missed most of them. When she eventually came to a session, she wouldn't let me say much and complained repeatedly about her past sufferings and loneliness. All those times I felt like I was set aside and left as a mere observer of this process. During this period, our sessions were mainly focused on the injustice of life, on her rage, and on the methods she adopted to protect herself from the world she imagined was always hostile to her. On one occasion, she came to me and gave me the chance to have the following conversation. That was about 4 years we had been together. And so Sadie said, "I want to know what you really see in me. I have always wanted to know if people saw bad things in me that kept them distant. There must be something very wrong with me. Otherwise, what would explain my own mother rejecting me even before I was born?" And I said, "When you first arrived here, you also thought I rejected you, and I didn't." And Sally said, "But you did. I don't want to talk about this again because this makes me angry, but you did, and you won't admit it anyway." Then I said, "Perhaps what you see as evil in you is your rage for having been so rejected. And on the other hand, you won't consider that you might also have rejected people around you in response to not trusting them."
What's so lovely about your thought process is that you acknowledge both the coldness that she was on the receiving end of and also the coldness that she now unknowingly inflicts on others, which is the hardest thing for traumatized patients to become aware of, that they identify with the coldness and the sadism of their tormentors. And you get both of those in your encounter with her in that last intervention.
Yes, that's more or less what you asked me, the role we have as analysts, and to show that there is something going on and that the person exists and takes part of it. And I think that's very important because this is a way of saying, "I'm seeing you. You are making me distant. And that's why I I'm not able to get close enough."
You're both seeing their own unacknowledged aggressiveness and still accepting them despite it, which is brand new for most patients, certainly it's sounding for her. How does one do that with patients that can't come 5 times a week or even twice a week? How do you apply that in your work in the clinics, in the university, and with financially struggling patients or people even who have jobs and can't come, you know, the many circumstances that prevent intensive treatment that are reality-based?
Many patients at the university I'm able to see once a week. And I noticed that the frequency is important. It helps a lot. But what really makes the difference is that you don't forget your patient. I see a patient once a week, and when I see the patient again, I talk about the things he told me the week before.
Yeah, that's quite powerful.
So he knows that he stayed with me all this time.
Which is, at the same time, in my experience, so remarkable to them. They can't believe it, and they won't believe it because it awakens a longing in them to be known and cared for that is terrifying.
That's it. They come and ask me, "How can you remember that?" And I say, "Because I pay attention in everything you say. And you have to be aware of that because I can use everything you say in your favor and I won't forget."
Yeah, you have to be, one as a clinician has to be aware of things that one might take for granted are earth-shattering to patients, to be known and cared for and remembered. Sometimes patients will say, you must take a lot of notes that you remember all these things, and I don't. And it's the same experience you're describing, right?
I don't take any notes. And after a while, let's say a while, some years, they are not surprised by it anymore. They expect me to know.
And they can do that with other people. That's the real sign of progress. They take that ability and they start remembering people in their own life.
Right.
And are broadened and deepened in that ability. It's when it works, it's really remarkable. Tell us, if you will, what are things like in Brazil in general and in the Brazil psychiatric and psychoanalytic community? I know there have been political changes in Brazil. And where is your focus on knowing people, your teaching others about this, the importance of that? How does it fit into the cultural, medical, and psychoanalytic community?
Well, it's a very, very hard situation. I don't think we do have a very good assistance here in Brazil. Psychoanalytically speaking, I don't know about in the rest of the world. I do suspect that, not for the same reasons, but there must be a problem there too, because the addiction is such a huge health problem that they really get impressed that, with a few exceptions, of course, so little is written about it. For the first time, there is a subcommittee on addiction in IPA. Up to a few years ago, there was nothing. In the societies, there are quite a number of analysts who think that they can do nothing for this kind of patients. And I think they are completely wrong, because it's not true if I tell you that I can help everyone, because I can't. But I wouldn't say that I could help anyone in any condition.
Of course, none of us can.
Yeah, but I can help some people, and they come to me. They come for help. So I think we as analysts, we have to reconsider the situation and to know how important we are, because we reach the deepest level, which is fundamental for the organization of the personality of the patient. We don't treat symptoms, but we treat or we deal with the origins. And through transference, counter-transference, we can enter the scene. And being a part of the scene, like a cast member, like saying, you can do something different, not what the patient expected you to do, but something that you're doing in a completely different way, which is very confusing for the patient, but very helpful as well.
You know, we began our talk today with my asking, what can a psychoanalyst contribute? And you just, in the last couple of moments, answered that as beautifully as I've ever heard it. So I feel privileged to be in conversation with you about it. And I hope our audience appreciates how vital what you've said is and how important the work you've described is.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's a privilege to be here, having the chance to talk about it, because this is another thing. We don't get a lot of chance to talk about the work we do, because if people don't believe we can do much, they don't want to listen to.
And I'm glad to be a part of. Thank you so much for sharing. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.